Doug Ford has been elected Ontario Premier, and he looks like Sylvester when he just got caught eating Tweety Bird. I mean, he looks like the most guilty, lying, just disingenuous sack of garbage. I mean, look at him. Like a giant demonic ferret. Looks like an evil hedgehog that just ate your freedoms.
There you have it, folks. Even Alex Jones thinks that Doug Ford has some skeletons in his closet. This is Left Turn Canada. I'm Andy Burkowski, joined always by my co-host that knows the most, Christo Avelis. Christo, it has been a busy week for us here in Ontario, eh?
Woo! I mean, that Alex Jones clip right off the top, right? I mean, for those, for folks who don't know, that is the gay frog guy.
The gay
that
frog guy. That's him.
That is the, yeah, that is the guy who says that they're make the water is being poisoned to turn frogs gay. Just like a nutter, even in relation to the rest of the American right. And even he is turning on Doug Ford. So we're going to talk all about how Doug Ford is even more hated than he has been. And we're going to talk about how, you know, it's just been a crazy week for him and frankly for everyone in this forsaken province.
It really did feel when he first announced on, I think it was Friday or maybe Thursday, I can't remember.
I think it was Friday. Yeah.
The new sweeping changes that didn't really address, like now that we know what they were, they didn't address the Ontario Science Table's feelings of what needed to be done to deal with the pandemic. It had a lot to do with police oversight and in Alex Jones's mind and a lot of conservatives' mind, almost meaning, you know, enacting a police state where police can stop you for any reason. And then to upset the liberals, we also had, you know, we're going to close down all of the playgrounds was one of the ideas that Doug Ford has pushed. Since that time, I believe he has gone back on both of those edicts in some degree. And that kind of was all highlighted today. When he, after he was isolated because he might have had COVID, someone on his team might have, we learned that he can't use a laptop. Like, it was just been increasingly embarrassing.
He has today, literally, folks, he has a stack of old 2014 Blackberries. You know, the old school Blackberries.
I didn't know that.
Because he hasn't learned how to use a modern, it's in the same story as the laptop story. And so, you know, to kind of underline his tech illiteracy, he literally buys in bulk old 2014 Blackberries because he doesn't want to learn how to use a modern Android or iPhone smartphone. And the phones barely work. They can't send him PDFs on them reliably. And they conk out easily. And so he just cracks open a new 2014 Blackberry when he needs one. So this is our premier, folks.
This is our leader. And today we got to hear our leader as he finally was succumbing to a lot of this pressure from both sides. He had this to say, and unfortunately, it seemed to work on some people.
Hold the hand of their mom or dad as it passed away because of COVID-19 restrictions in hospitals. Healthcare workers who've been pushed to the absolute limit, working to save lives. I want you to know that I hear you. I understand you're going through. I understand your frustration. This experience, this pandemic, is something that has affected every single person.
So it does seem like he is genuinely upset. What is he genuinely upset about? I don't know if it's the plight of his fellow Ontarians or that maybe after decades in politics, completely destroying everyone in his path in Toronto City Hall and bullying his way into the premiership, that maybe he's not doing so well. But unfortunately, like we said, it seems to be working on some journalists and some people, those crocodile tears. Now, you brought this to my attention. You know, what do you think that fact that Doug Ford now is weeping at the plight of Ontarians?
Yeah, I mean, he's crying because he knows that he's in huge trouble politically, right? And that people are he's been caught out. He didn't do enough, as we've noted, as so many others have noted. Medical professionals, doctors, epidemiologists, public health officials. He hasn't done nearly enough. Either when he's given advice, he follows it insufficiently, meaning rendering it meaningless. They tell him to do something, he'll do it a quarter of the way, half of the way, or he'll do the opposite. We've seen him play politics with areas designated hotspots. Some of the areas he's designated as hotspots fall below the provincial COVID testing rate average and just happen to be, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, areas that have voted for the Progressive Conservatives. And so all of these
let's even pause for a second there, because I know you've written on this in the past. But that is such unbelievable, like Cuomo-esque fascist bullshit when it comes to the allocation of our public health. There's no reason why. I think there was a quote of the area you're in, the Kingston area, that do you have that info with you right now? I don't think I have it on top of my head.
Well, basically, without getting bogged down in the numbers, I mean, we talked about this and I wrote about it back when it happened, is that, you know, Kingston is part of one of the pilot programs to put vaccines in pharmacies, and Kingston has a very low caseload of COVID, and our test positive rate is very low, meaning that, you know, people aren't testing positive a whole lot of the time. We're very lucky here in Kingston that COVID has relatively spared us. Whereas Brampton, which is very much a racialized community, Kingston ubiquitously white, has very, very few vaccines per pharmacy, and it's a lot harder for people to get access to vaccines, even though they both, in terms of raw cases and also positivity rate, are significantly higher than Kingston. And whether it's politics or not, or race or not, I mean, it's reasonable to think. I mean, on the one hand, Kingston is in no way a conservative city. The 401, north of the 401 in Kingston, north of the highway, is technically in a sort of broad rural conservative riding. But the bulk of Kingston itself is an NDP riding that is an NDP liberal swing riding, in a sense, right? So it's conservatives are not competitive in urban Kingston, but certainly people have noticed that Kingston seems to be getting more priority despite being far less ravaged by this disease.
And this is happening, like you said, across the province in different areas. You're speaking about Brampton. My family still lives there. And though, even though the whole area code of Brampton is considered a hotspot, that program that you were talking about to get that early access for people that are 18 years of age and older to get vaccinated is only available, I think, in one specific area where the cases are more extreme. So the logic of, you know, overall recognizing that the whole city is at risk, but only willing to give vaccinations to a certain sect of people that are suffering the worst within that sect, just seems like a gross miscalculation. Like, it just doesn't seem like, again, neither of us are doctors, but when the doctors have spoken about this, there seems to be a consensus that it makes more sense to put this vaccine in the hands of people who are more at risk en masse. And right now, a lot of the reason that these people are at risk are because of the choices that the Ford government has made during the pandemic and before the pandemic. So the idea that he would cry that people are dying when Doug Ford continues to not work with the opposition whatsoever on getting any real substantive changes is more than sickening. It's criminal. And there's been calls this last week for Doug Ford to resign, you know, in the Washington Post. Big
friend of the show, David Moskrop. I did an interview on his podcast recently. It was the number one for a couple hours at least, the number one read thing on the Washington Post.
And that tells you something. Like, this this consensus is pushing past our borders here in Ontario. And you were touching on it there, but I think it behooves us to look back at the things Doug Ford has done wrong. We talked about cutting paid sick leave. He was saying today, blaming the federal government, of course, that their services aren't adequate, which is hilarious because that's kind of what, you know, most of the people in Ontario were saying before they decided to make these cuts. He's saying he might bring it back in some capacity. He, of course, gutted healthcare management budgets like the LIN programs and things like that, that would have been a massive help during this pandemic, would have been essential for exactly this moment now of the bureaucracy that's associated with vaccines and getting it to the most people. Perhaps the most sickening thing was the cuts to retirement homes and the budgeting there. Like, it's very clear that those cuts led to deaths early on in this pandemic. But he's made so many other mistakes that we're almost forgetting that. He refused help from the feds, saying we don't need it because Justin Trudeau was asking, like we said, the vaccine rollouts were in places that they shouldn't be. All throughout this, too, he blamed young kids meeting up on the streets of Toronto and Brampton as the reason this was happening. We have the police, you know, overreach, shutting down parks, and just everything that you could possibly do wrong here seems to have been done wrong by Doug Ford. And it all seems to serve this idea of, you know, capital, I think, in the broadest terms. The choices that he's making early on to not ensure that the big businesses, the manufacturing centers, the distribution centers that had these major outbreaks were closed and these people were protected shows what this government feels like about its people. That it, clearly there is a divide, and we talked about it before, but this pandemic has showed that class divide stronger than ever before. And I don't know how you can be in this province or be a conscionable person and not see that Doug Ford is not doing these things for you. And I think the constituents see that he's serving is getting smaller and smaller because he keeps making these hilarious mistakes. So we talked about it before. Doug Ford must resign. What does that actually mean? Like, what do you think that would look like, Christo? And, you know, do you think that can actually happen?
I'm not sure. I'm still skeptical. In terms of the immediate politics of it all, I mean, if Ford was to go, if he was to resign or be forced out by his own party, it would not lead to an election, almost certainly, at least not in the immediate term, because the Conservatives have a majority government, and Ford is, if he's not premier, he is simply just one random member of the legislature. And so long as the Conservatives can command a majority, it's sort of irrelevant who premier is in that sense. So if he's forced out, he could be replaced by, say, Christine Elliott or whoever they can get to fill that position. That person would immediately become premier. There's not another election scheduled, basically, until about this time next year, likely a few more months after that. And so, in essence, they could hypothetically do a sort of palace coup and force Ford out if the Conservatives wanted to do that and replace him. But if the Conservative Party isn't willing to implement the policies, then yeah, maybe you get rid of Ford's personal incompetence. But it's not just about his personal incompetence. It's also about his ideological flaws. And there's no guarantee that the next Conservative leader, in fact, I would say there's a strong likelihood they wouldn't do the right thing and simply give these murderous policies a more polished sheen, right? And so there's, frankly, it's hard from a governing perspective. You're not, the government is not going to fall over this immediately. If Ford goes, you still have the same base scenario, which is a Conservative majority government where the vast majority of people are unhappy. And it's hard to say what comes of that. I definitely,
it almost helps the Conservatives as a party more if he does go, as opposed to helping us living here in Ontario. Because like you said,
I mean, hypothetically, yeah. I mean, yeah. If the issue is with Ford more than the party, then hypothetically, yes. Now, that other person may end up being even less popular by the time they get to an election, so you're never 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look at this, I mean, on the one hand, the Conservatives are in a tough place. We saw some recent polling that shows Ford is deeply unpopular, but his disapproval rating has only gone up 2 points.
Now, his 2 points rating, in a week, yeah, in a week, week, when he has week, been hated, yeah, by everyone, yeah, where he's been made fun, yeah, of by major editorial outlets around North America, and he's, yeah, it's 2 points down. It's insane.
Now, he has lost 6% approval.
Yeah.
So he's -8 in the week, which is significant, but you think about it, so he's lost a bit of his supporters back into neutral, and a few people that were neutral likely no longer like him, but, you know, it's not as much as a cratering as I would have thought, but I definitely think things have turned. I definitely think things have turned. And one thing you are seeing in some recent polling is while Ford's personal numbers haven't moved that much, you're starting to see the conservatives pay the price politically. Now, we're a long ways away from the election, but in some polls, you're effectively showing them in a tie with the liberals, the NDP close behind. Whereas a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, when we were talking about this, we were sort of baffled by the fact that Ford is murdering workers. Ford is failing in this. He's clearly not listening to science. He's putting politics ahead of science, even more than politicians normally do. And the conservatives were still polling in the high 30s, which would likely keep them in majority territory or a very, very strong minority government. And so we were thinking, like, okay, Ford's clearly getting hammered here by a lot of people, but he still would be premier if an election was held today. Now that's not necessarily the case. And so it could be an example of Ford's disapproval ratings are already really, really, really bad. So it's hard to go lower, right? If his party starts paying the price in the polls consistently, that's when you might see some things change. And I mean, that's what we saw. Like, I mean, they have a big majority government. They can do what they want. But, you know, they proposed all these things and then they backtracked on it. They backtracked partially on the cop thing. They backtracked on closing some of the parks, all these sorts of things.
Yeah,
that they did.
Those two big missteps were hilarious because they hit.
And they got immediate pushback.
On every sort pushback. Of demo that they need, you know, they need the, you know, the secretly bigoted and capitalist neoliberals that are conservative. And of course, the people that are batshit crazy and think that anyone who isn't conservative is a communist. You had police takeover saying that, you know, we have this new police state and, you know, why can't my kids play on playground? So it was just a hilarious miscalculation that once again, Ontario Science Table said, the co-chairs are there, that this is not what they recommended remotely when they were talking to the province about what is needed to deal with this pandemic. So it seems to be that it was entirely ideological. And the funny thing is that as soon as something is unpopular, I thought that at the very least, Doug Ford was true to his ideology. But he has been hurt by this so much that we showed that this is what happens when you have conservative governance, when you need to care about your citizens. If you stick to the actual ideology of these people, it is designed to be oppressive to groups of people. It has to be so that other groups can survive. And I thought at the very least he would stick with it with his horrible ideas. But even now he's showing he doesn't even have the gumption to take the hits. And
well,
he's not true there.
We have to wait and see though, right? Because I mean, again, we still don't have paid sick leave. They say they're working on it. And so it's like they've sacrificed on some of the things, but not all of the things. And like, look, last week when this broke, so like we recorded on Thursday and we ripped Ford a little bit. We actually took a break on Ford last week, which was good because we saved up all our energy.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
We talked about New Brunswick and all of these sorts of things. After that, this story broke on Friday that he's basically going to give the police these unprecedented powers. They're shutting down parks, but they're not really doing anything to curtail the actual epicenters, which are workplaces. Just an absolute torrent. I wrote a piece for Canadian Dimension. Lots of people were ripping them on social media. But like the fact around that time, they also wanted to postpone the legislature, basically give themselves a vacay and so they could all disperse and get rid of the media attention that was kind of bearing down on them. And Horwath and the NDP said, no, unless you implement some fairly common sense policies. They weren't asking for anything outlandish. All they really wanted was one, the police powers eliminated, not just scaled back, not just qualified, but these new police powers eliminated. They also wanted to see paid sick days, a paid sick day policy, and workers being given paid time off so that they can go get vaccinated. So that if you're, you know, if you have a vaccine appointment, but it's during your work hours, you don't have to choose between getting vaccinated and missing out on your pay. And these are all bog standard, bare minimum things, right? One, don't Gestapo us. Two, sick workers shouldn't have to choose between their health and their coworkers' health and survival. And three, workers shouldn't have to choose between vaccination and their paychecks. All of that's perfectly reasonable. And I bet if you polled on that stuff, they would all pull well into the 60s, 70s, and conservatives would support all of those things too, right? But they have not done that yet, and I don't know if it's a mixture of they just don't want to do it and hoping it'll blow over. The donors are going to be mad. Oh, yeah. We haven't even talked about this fucking ghoul. He was like, he didn't show up the question period earlier on in the week. So he let his other ministers take the hits. Turns out that he's doing a $1,000 a head Zoom fundraiser with top conservative donors, right? You know, take it up to $1,000 a head in the room. To basically chat up with elite conservatives while he's hiding away from the public and hiding away from the opposition, who just wants people to get some basic, protection. Not even anything is, you might even say like it's the NDP could have been bolder in what they asked for, if anything, but it was perfectly reasonable and they have not done it yet. And you say, well, maybe they will, maybe they're going to do it, but I don't know. I think that honestly, they're like, they're probably doing the calculations. It's like, well, how many more workers are going to die? Is it 10,000? Like, if it's 10, maybe we need to do something because the polls are going to take a hit. But like, if it's only going to be like 5,000 more people, we'd rather just let them die than give them sick.
Give them sick leave, but we would rather let them die than admit for a second that the NDP are correct or that we might need help from Justin Trudeau. Like, that comment was insane when Trudeau said, we'll have the Red Cross come and help with some of the vaccine allocations, basically saying in the midst of all this, Ford, we don't need that, we're gonna be okay. And it's just like, at what point are we allowed to say, and it's public consensus on like mainstream CBC media, that Doug Ford is killing Ontarians for the sake of politics? Like, when is that no longer just outlandish, left-wing propaganda, but it's a common consensus that it's all for politicking? And like, maybe that rule book worked for him, like enough people were okay with that degree of death because it didn't affect their daily life. But now that there's a pandemic, it just doesn't work. And I think we're seeing that with some of the polling that you're mentioning. We were talking about this before we recorded. As soon as the extra police powers were issued, there's a big blow up last weekend, and a lot of local municipalities and police precincts came out on Twitter and said, don't worry, we're not going to do this. We're going to follow the stated rules beforehand. The OPP, though, came out and said, no, we're definitely going to do this. We're going to follow what the premier said and make sure that people are safe. And then a couple days later, there's a video of an OPP officer in Gravenhurst, pushing over a kid that's on a scooter, a 12-year-old, this big beefy dude pushing over a child, citing, it's COVID restrictions, you need to go back inside. So already there's evidence of that. And I know you and I had a bit of a disagreement here, that the positivity of trying to, at least municipalities are saying they're not going to do it. For me, I nothing highlights the issues with our country more than having different police precincts explaining to, the scared white Toronto Sun reporters that are now against Ford for the first time ever, that no, we're not actually going to be a police state, while the rest of us just kind of have to, rely on their word in a lot of ways. Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, to be clear, my perspective was,
I know you're not on that other side. Yeah.
which was not necessarily like, oh, phew, there's nothing to worry about, but more, Doug Ford is generally likely well received by the police. Conservative leaders tend to be. And so for police departments immediately en masse to contradict the provincial government shows that they realized, one, how unpopular this was going to be, and two, how resource intensive this could potentially be, that they came out and spoke against it, which is likely the reason the things were scaled back at all in the first place. This isn't to say that I necessarily believe them 100%, but that the reason why all of these powers were scaled back was not just the loudness of the voice, but the kind of diversity of the voices. Conservatives were mad, cops were mad, mayors of all political stripes were mad, and of course the people that are usually mad at Ford, people like yourself and myself and so many others, were madder than usual. And I think that that's what matters. But you're right, 100%. Whether the powers are scaled back or not, it was always going to be something that was going to disproportionately target Black people, Indigenous people, racialized people, poor people, homeless people. You know, it was never going to be a justly enforced law. It's like carding on steroids.
Yeah, absolutely. So at least, you know, they are hopefully pushing that back, but there's no guarantees with any of this. This is the problem, that I don't know how anyone, I think there were some reporters that were falling for this, you know, crocodile tears approach from Doug Ford earlier today, but there were a lot that weren't, that were pushing him, saying, you know, you're doing exactly the opposite of what people are suggesting. You know, what do you mean the buck stops here? You know, it's very clear that the criticism is out there. And there was a deep miscalculation by the conservatives that most of the public was so perhaps beaten down and desperate and fallen into our bleak despair because of this pandemic that we wouldn't have that outrage. And I think the only benefit that I can look at here is that it has reinvigorated a populace that I think was feeling quite down and broken by this. It's very easy now to galvanize against an enemy here.
Yeah, and people are energized. People were mad at Ford, but I think just exhausted. Now people seem to be fired up a little bit.
He is clearly the enemy to the people of Ontario because of the choices he's making, and him crying about people dying because he has cut their social services that would have protect them is performative and bleak and fucking terrifying. Like, that's
he could pass paid sick days today. There's already built, like, the liberal, they're not technically a party, the Liberal Party, but the liberal MPPs have a bill. The NDP has a bill. Literally today, he could pass something in the like, if he said, we're going to vote for it, we're going to take the opposition's bill, we can do it. We don't even need to write a new bill and we'll do it. He could do that today. And the goddamn ghoul is refusing.
And it's not only, of course, the populace that is upset about this, but politicians from across the aisle are fuming in a lot of ways because they're feeling the pressure from their constituents. We today have the opportunity to speak with Matthew Green, the NDP MP from the Hamilton region, about this issue of how it's affecting his constituents and, of course, federally, what Trudeau is doing and isn't doing, and the big budget that was released this week, and you know, the perspective from the NDP, maybe some alternatives. So we're very happy to have Matthew here.
So Matthew, thanks for joining us, MP from Hamilton Center. Always great to have him on. He's been on my YouTube channel. Matthew, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, man. I had to spend the morning sitting through a Liberal filibuster trying to have them hide, you know, documents that we wanted that committee, but it's just another day in the office.
So, you know, we've been talking a lot about Doug Ford. And as you noted so eloquently, I noted this in my Canadian Dimension article, Doug Ford is fucking up. you know, I know that's an evergreen statement, but in the last couple weeks in particular, it's been especially bad. And I know you're a federal MP, but, you know, you represent the working class and middle class people of Hamilton Center. So I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective as a representative, like, how has Ford's failures impacted, like, your people?
Well, I'll begin by saying that not only is it impacting our people, it's costing lives.
Yeah.
And I put that tweet out there in reference to the Dave Chappelle skits and just the ongoing history of the way in which governments are fucking up when it comes to very vulnerable communities. And I think about the decisions that are made, and it reminds me of the adage of, like, you know, don't attribute to malice what you can account for in incompetence. And I want to think it's incompetence. It's actually that bad that I want to think it's incompetence. But unfortunately, the evidence is suggesting that political decisions were made to interfere with the Ontario Vaccine Task Force, the distribution task force, that withdrew distribution of life-saving vaccines to known hotspots in favor of PC ridings. That is malicious. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, worthy of further investigation in a post-mortem on what has happened during COVID.
Yes.
But you have a government here who is flying by the seat of their pants, ignoring all evidence-based decision-making by the experts we have, unfortunately, a public health apparatus officially, which has been politicized to the point in which rank and file doctors, nurses, healthcare professionals are having to resort to whistleblowing on decisions that are made at every step along the way. And with the double mutated variants that are coming in, this third wave that is seeing infection rates, hospitalization rates, and mortality rates higher than at any point in COVID, it begs the question, a year and a half into this, how are we still not prepared?
Well, I'm just hearing you say that and then just noting what Ford has said and then gone back on and the different messaging that's putting out there. I think it's really hard just for a regular person to not be really disillusioned with the role of politicians in our province and just even in our society. You know, at what point do you think it's required to just stop the political games? Because I think most people recognize that politicians are advocating for their party. You know, that's a lot to do with why you're there. But from what we're seeing from Ford, it seems like the point is only to win political victories when we're dealing with, you know, the worst crisis our country has maybe ever faced. So, you know, at what point is the politics need to end? And what do you say to those people that are looking at this and just completely disillusioned with politicians in general?
Well, I would say that we have legislation in place for that under the Emergency Act, which clearly stipulates when there's a public welfare emergency. I don't think anybody, whether you're a constitutional expert or a layperson, would argue that COVID-19, 20, and now 21 is most certainly a public welfare emergency. And the biggest challenge that people have in sifting through all the spin and all the political bullshit is who is responsible. So you have a federal government who has sat back over the course of this pandemic and said that their only responsibility is in procuring vaccines, that they take no responsibility in the distribution. They take no responsibility in the application and implementation of paid sick days. They take no responsibility in the way that they have made decisions to use economic labor force calculus to determine the minimum amount they can provide people through CERB versus what they're giving people through the wage subsidies. So we are forcing people into unsafe work environments, knowing that the breakouts are not in the parks and playgrounds, as Doug Ford identified in his totalitarian emergency order, but are in the meatpacking plants, the logistics plants, the places like Amazon, long-term care facilities, and others, which in which all levels of government have refused to intervene in the private sector.
Yeah. Well, ahead, I mean, Kristen. on this note, I mean, and I've been calling for it, a lot of people have been calling for it, but you suggested that the federal government has to at least strongly consider, I know Jagmeet has done it as well, to implement some sort of emergency power to save the people of Ontario from this provincial government's incompetence. And I'm wondering if you could, you know, maybe elaborate on what you feel the federal government needs to do to step up and use the power it has, rather than just simply for its own political purposes, letting Ford kill people so they can keep their hands clean.
It is wild in terms of the negligence leading to death. And when I say that, again, in the Emergency Act, we can provide parallel rollouts to you know, to provide distribution of vaccines, that we can have the ability at the federal level of government to have done max vaccinations, much in the same way that Joe Biden did in California with Gavin Newsom, where you have a population that is about the same, but they have actually successfully vaccinated 10 times the population in California than we have in Canada with very similar population bases. And yet again, they refuse to enact it. Under the Department of Health Act, there is the ability for us to have interim orders where we could have had direct interventions on the healthcare of Canadians. And I think, you know, this goes back to the Liberal government's very savvy and cynical way in which they interpret our Health Act. They interpret our Health Act as not being a partnership and shared responsibility, but they have essentially abrogated their responsibilities onto the provinces, who in the beginning saw the popularity of the crisis and took it. And now, as we've seen across the country, not just in Ontario, but let's be clear, from BC to Alberta to Manitoba and Saskatchewan, Quebec, there has been significant loss and significant reoccurrences now in this third wave. Okay. So we have always had the power federally, but we have not had the political will.
And do you think, you know, now in this moment, you talked about it, that there's been failures across the board, across the country. Do you think that it would benefit Ontario and the people you represent if Doug Ford resigned tomorrow? And if he did, you know, what do you hope would be happening differently here?
Well, you know, I want to talk about what is a political practicality. And I don't think it's realistic to think that we can shame the shameless in this realm. I don't think a guy, an authoritarian strongman like Doug Ford, steps down for any reason, by the way, much in the same cloth of a Donald Trump. He will continue to antagonize, and you know, and his only recovery is his ability to sound contrite in the moment. And he tried to do that today with his press conference, but I don't think that's going to happen. What I do think needs to happen is that there needs to not just be a consideration, and I've called out this for months now, but there needs to be an implementation of the Emergency Act to immediately provide paid sick days, to immediately provide parallel rollout in the vaccinations. And what I think would happen if we reveal that the federal government was responsible and involved in this process, that I actually happen to think that there's some truth about the supply shortages. And I'm not here to defend Doug Ford or any of these provincial ghouls, but I think that there's, having sat on committees that are responsible for procurement, I think that there's actually a whole lot of smokescreen about what we're actually delivering in terms of vaccines. And so by putting this back to the federal government and saying, okay, if you're saying that these tens of millions of vaccines, the largest and most diverse portfolio of vaccines in the world, is being delivered for Canadians, then show the federal leadership and courage to be involved in the actual inoculation of Canadians. And that wouldn't take much. Mm-hmm. We have frontline nurses. I mean, we had to call in Yukon and these other territories to help send medical assistance to Ontario. And, you know, like, without getting overly dramatic, we have in Hamilton Center a football stadium for the Hamilton Ticats. We still call it Iverwind Stadium. And Iverwind Stadium seats about 20,000 people. And I think about a doomsday scenario where there would be a threat, a meteor, or something unforeseen, act of God, that would put 20,000, you know, people at risk at Iverwind Stadium. And I ask myself, and I ask Canadians, like, what would you want government to do to stop that? And I think that every Canadian would say they would want them to do absolutely everything within their power to stop that. And I would say that that is exactly what has happened with COVID. And we have not done everything within our power to stop these deaths.
Well, I guess just to follow up to that, why do you think there has been this timidity with actually dealing with it like it is, you know, a meteor coming to kill us? Like, is it just politics? Is it just, you know, trying to remain the status quo? Or is there something maybe even a little more duplicitous here?
I would say that we have governments that are led by polling, that is led by media cycles that are fed by governments. Jesus. So when you have political power that has the ability to stand before a mic and seem like they are in the power and control of an emergency situation, like it's some kind of goddamn Netflix series, rather than handing the keys of these decisions right over to public health agencies in an emergency order that allowed them to make evidence-based decisions absent of political calculation, that more people would have been vaccinated by now. We would have had more financial supports to frontline people. And perhaps, just perhaps, we would not be in this vicious third wave with double mutated variants.
Go ahead, Christo.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree. I mean, look, in the United States, they have literal COVID denying governors, right? They literally have people that are, that leap over Doug Ford in some ways in their in their right wing ideology, at least as expressed, and they can still get people vaccinated there. So clearly federal leadership is doing something in the United States that it isn't doing in Canada, whether it's on the procurement side or whether it's on the coordination side, probably a bit of both. They're not doing enough. And of course, as we've talked about, as you've talked about, and it's not just the Trudeau Liberals, to be fair, but Canada has had a generational deficit in its ability to produce essential pharmaceuticals domestically, and that includes vaccines. And this government has been in power for 6 odd years now and has not addressed that. And, you know, I think that we could talk a little bit about how the federal budget, which just dropped, I know it was kind of dwarfed by this story, but has some good things in it, to be fair, but utterly drops the ball with regards to the public health of Canadians.
It absolutely and utterly drops the ball. And I think that what I'm left with as one of the 338 members of the House of Commons in these crises, being at the tables around procurement, around public health, around ethics, it's left me really wondering and soul searching, what is the point of the federal government if in this biggest generational crisis that we are not responding to the needs of Canadians, that we are abrogating our responsibilities to the lower levels of government? What is the fucking point? Like, at this point, I'm looking at it and saying, maybe Quebec's onto something. Maybe, you know, Alberta's onto something. Yeah. Like, if everybody's going to just go their separate directions and wing it, they don't understand science. They don't understand how disease works, how airborne vectors work. There's no jurisdiction, constitutional jurisdiction of COVID. And then we have a government, even in this last budget, who in the worst public health emergency in 100 years, yeah, still refuses to commit to pharmacare, yeah, still refuses to have nationalized public production of life-saving vaccines through bodies like Sanofi or the, you know, the related Connaught Labs, which was a Canadian production. And I think, like, they take the public for granted. They treat us as stupid in the way in which people just look at this stuff and think it's not possible without recognizing that not only is it possible, it already was. We already had these things. And if we had had subsequent investments, even post-SARS, because none of this is new, by the way, all of the emergency planning, preparedness, all the things that we should have relied on from the federal side of government, surveillance of the explosion of these infection rates, were ignored.
Mm-hmm.
We actually shut down our national emergency strategic stockpile and threw away N95 masks in the year leading up to COVID.
Jeez, well, you talked about it there, you know. Why do we have the federal government? How do people not just, you know, rise up and say we need something more from the people that we elect? You know, we're all in little bubbles here, you know, literally and figuratively in a lot of ways. So it's hard to get the temperature of just the general populace. But do you think that we're getting closer to a point where Canadians or people in Ontario, people in your jurisdiction there, have just had enough and would they want to push that feeling onto some sort of change just to make it mean something? Because I know the one benefit, I think, maybe of this Doug Ford entire ghoulish fiasco is it seems to have fired people up. We were desperate before and we were broken down, but now there is a clear person that is killing us because of these choices. You know, do you think from your perspective that people are in a position now to maybe ask for more? Are we still just, you know, it's hard. We're so beaten down by this. I'd love to know where you land.
While I think it's important to leave your listeners with a growing sense of hope, if you would ask me this question.
Don't lie to us, Matthew.
No, I'm always going to keep it real, Crystal. That's my promise.
Yeah.
That if this was 2 months ago, I would have said absolutely in the second wave that we were converting outrage into action, that I saw, you know, by and large, unions taking better, more principled positions, that I saw the civic society kind of organizing in mutual aid and in, you know, coming out of the BLM movement. I saw some real beauty in that. But I'll share with you that there seems to be a growing inertia and desperation in this third wave.
Mm-hmm.
It has me worried. And I see it reflected in the rising polls of like Stephen Del Duca, provincially, yeah. Mm-hmm. That despite the work of the NDP caucus in calling the question time and time again on this Doug Ford government, the attribution is going to this reverting back to this lesser of two evils. But our healthcare situation is the place that it's in not because of Doug Ford, as ghoulish as he is, but because of the 15 years of liberalism. Mm-hmm. Dalton McGuinty, Kathleen Wynne, underfunding public health, privatizing P3 models, our public healthcare, our public education system, all the same. And yet in the polls, there seems to be a comfort in the devil they know, rather than embracing and accepting that the indictment of the failures of right-wing and liberal ideology is that they solely rely on the private sector to solve our problems. And the private sector has fucking sold us out. There are $78 billion that were accumulated by our top 1%, $78 billion accumulated. You know, 87 families have more wealth than the bottom earning 12 million Canadians. And while everybody was losing their jobs, small businesses losing, you know, their livelihoods, the ultra wealthy in this country continue to profit. And the ultra wealthy in this country, by the way, they don't give a shit whether it's a conservative or a liberal government because it's business as usual. How do we know
that? Donate to both parties, man.
It's a capitalist government. That's all they
need. How do we know that to be true? Let's talk about that. The fact that in this budget, the fundamental question of who's going to pay for the recovery, liberals answered it in emphatic terms, not the ultra rich.
Mm-hmm. No wealth tax. No capital gains tax. Look, Joe Biden, and you know, this is not the Joe Biden power hour, folks. Yeah, I think
I am not a fan of Joe Biden, but plain talk is not bad.
Out. I don't know if you saw Matthew, but he's just come out with a pretty bold capital gains proposal to significantly increase just today. And you know, here in Canada, we have this bullshit model where essentially, without complicating it too much, if you earn your income off profit, whether it's landlording or stock speculation or whatever, you pay half the tax rate that somebody who works as a carpenter or a teacher or a nurse or whatever, a labor-based income, pays. And that's an issue that predated COVID. And as Matthew's noting, I mean, we're in a situation here where the only appreciable tax increase is a window show luxury tax on fancy cars and boats, which is going to raise.
I'm sorry. It's making me laugh there.
And like,
we're in this crisis and it's, let's make sure they,
Matthew, we've talked about this multiple times on my YouTube channel, and I've written about it in Jacobin. Goddamn, two thirds of conservative voters want a wealth tax, and it's not in this budget, and it's never going to be in a liberal budget because they don't give a damn about what Canadians want. They give a damn about what the donors want. And the corporations won.
It is wild. And I said this to Lance just recently, I think on the Serbs, talking about how, we're getting outflanked by Biden on corporate tax, for Christ's sake. The old adage that
Delaware Biden. Yeah.
Yeah. Delaware Joe is to the left of Trudeau on increasing amounts of issues.
But the contrasts are becoming stark because what has been demystified is the mythology of Canadian progressivism under the Liberal Party. And a generation sees that. They're calling it for what it is.
Yeah.
Older generations, by the way, seniors, people living with disabilities, they see that. The 2015 Trudeau government is no more. That lie has been told. It has been shown to be wanting. And what is left, I believe, is an opportunity to provide a more compelling alternative, a more democratic alternative to not just our democracy, but also to our economy. And I feel like that's what's at the heart of the matter with where we struggle as New Democrats to tell those stories in ways that break through, because much of the breakthroughs happen on mass media. And the reason why we're seeing a Del Duca bounce back, a guy who doesn't even have an official party, doesn't even have a seat in the House, in the legislature, actually have these artificially floated numbers because they give them disproportionate cover. Now, what we fail to do across the entire country, I believe, is to do what we're doing right now, which is to meet people where they're at, use alternate forms of media, podcasts, streaming, social media, old school, both Saul Alinsky and Marshall Gantz organizing agitation, because it should be a little bit of both, to get people to a place where they're ready to actually mobilize politically.
And I think that actually is a great answer to our Patreon question that we got this week from John, who was kind of echoing those sentiments. Why do the liberals seem to get all the credit for work that the NDP does, and, you know, the, kind of the take on strategic voting and how the NDP can start being recognized more fairly for the work that they do. I know you kind of answered that, but do you want to maybe reiterate? Do you have any ideas as to how, you know, the response to people that bring up strategic voting and how the NDP maybe can be more recognized for, you know, the accomplishments that y'all do?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, there is most certainly a manufacturing of consent within our mainstream media. Yeah. And it plays out in the narratives depending on where on the spectrum it is, from far right to center right. And that is the spectrum of our media. And I would like, you know, without commenting on CBC, because there's some great folks that are there, there seems to be a reluctance of journalism to hold government to account. There is no more holding feet to the fire. There is only punditry and spin. And I am gobsmacked when I know for a fact that people are hearing and seeing the same things that I'm hearing and seeing on committees and in the House. And yet the reports that come out are almost line by line the talking points of the two major political parties.
Yeah.
It is an incestuous relationship, one that shows both real, you know, sometimes intimate relationships, and I won't care to comment on that too much, but also like a bit of a, you know, an understanding in the way in which the pundits, the lobbyists, and the media are interchangeable with the partisan parties themselves. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think like for us, there needs to be a retreat to the grassroots. We need to recognize the regional support of our party. And I don't think it's shocking for people to just acknowledge that all politics in Canada are regional politics. Mm-hmm. All politics in Canada are identity politics. And I think that we are not 100% clear about exactly who we are in this moment. And so we need to get crystal clear on that. And I believe that we need to fight for a generational capture of young people in an actuarial way that accounts for their futures in a way that makes them responsive to what we're saying. Mm-hmm. That goes beyond the cynicism of the politics of just saying what you think people want to hear.
There you go, John. I think that gives us
shout out to John, by the way, for supporting this solid, like, you know, alternative to the mainstream pablum that we see in you know, doled out by Bay Street.
Well, we're trying, and I think I just wanted to speak to that. You're talking about the mainstream media and their effects. You know, in my work in Toronto media for 10 years, it was amazing to see the capitalist divide between the young people that wanted to, like you said, make a difference and had a real voice, and the real archaic ways that those alternative thoughts were beaten out of you due to lack of opportunities, or reinforce that the only way to get ahead is to get along. So of course, the people that are making these choices and the people that are asking these questions at the higher levels are those that had to go through the mill of ideology and capitalism, really, when it came to, at least in the Toronto experiences I've had. So, you know, that's a big reason why Christo and I and so many others have decided to make programs like this, and just to get people to have their voices, to talk to people like you that can answer the questions that, you know, maybe a CBC wouldn't ask, that maybe that definitely, you know, more conservative media wouldn't ask. So John and anyone else that's listening, please, you know, if you got a couple extra bucks, patreon.com/leftturncanada. And yeah, you can ask Matthew Green some questions just like that. So anyways, Christo, please continue.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great question by John, of course. And I think we'll certainly talk about, you know, these electoral questions as we, you know, approach elections and whatnot. But I think that this has been great. Matthew, one thing I'm trying to get a grasp of is, like, you know, how do we sell this vision? Because, you know, and you know, yourself and myself and many others are maybe on the left wing even of the NDP, but how do we push this vision of a challenge to the private sector? Like, healthcare is a place to do it, but it's like, how can we, within the party and beyond it, really, you know, put that vision there that, you know, capitalism, at least either in full or in large part, has caused this crisis and we need to challenge it. How do we do that given where people are? We have to meet people, but how do we meet them there in, mm-hmm. you know, 2021 Canada? Easy question, I know.
Yeah, I mean, like, I always try to frame popular education discussions around democratic economies on this idea of challenge, choice, and change. And rather than present, I think where we get caught up in the academia, the sectarian, like, competition of who could be the lefticist,
yeah,
is like just meeting people where they're at and understanding that people have the answers within them already.
Yeah.
They know this to not be an equitable economy. They know that their labor is being exploited. They know that governments are beholden to big corporations. And I have found it useful to ask people fundamental questions. Do you believe that somebody should work full time and still live below the poverty line? And they will say, no. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that in Canada, as prosperous as we are, that we should have people living in tents? And they say, absolutely not. Do you believe that everybody in Canada should have access to clean drinking water? Most Canadians, most, even the furthest right conservative yeah. ones will say, yes, they believe these things to be fundamentally true. And I think where we lose is we try to be too cute with our policy applications
yeah.
and not authentic enough in our communications delivery. And what we miss is this moment of populism that is seeking for moral clarity and a direction of outrage. And what we often respond with are somebody's thesis or yep. dissertation on the economic theory of the economy rather than saying, this is bullshit. And sometimes you just need to say, this is bullshit. Yep. Sometimes you need to just say, Doug Ford is fucking up. You know what I mean? Like,
yep. Yes,
people yeah. look at that. There doesn't have to be economic theory. Right-wing people reach out to me and they're like, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what we need to do, because in Hamilton, one of our sayings is that plain talk is not bad manners. You know, like, mm-hmm. we need to speak plainly about these issues. We need to tap into this like Paulo Vieira pedagogy that understands that people will know within their own hearts what is wrong. And we need to cut through the noise, and we need to play long game, because they do. We okay. chase polls. We chase election cycles. And what we don't chase is a shift in the public consciousness that is sticky and will hold with people beyond a headline.
Well, thank you, Matthew Green. We're not going to get better than that. Again, you know, some great messaging about what we can do moving forward, how our province and just generally Canada is fucking up. But at least, you know, there is some hope here. Like you said, we got to speak about it plainly, and things can change. We always like to have that message here whenever we talk about the bleakness of our society and, you know, capitalist hellscape, that it doesn't have to be like this. So, Matthew, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And we want to give a big thank you to Tim B, Joan, Shane, Daniel, Dave, John, Hamza, Benji, Josh, and Tim again, our patrons here. If you want to get involved, please again go to patreon.com/leftturncanada, and you'll be able to ask questions of MPs. That's pretty cool. All right, we'll see you next week.